This is The Political Animals, conversations at the intersection of religion, politics, and culture. I'm your host, Jonathan Cole, and in this episode, I talk to Professor Wayne Hudson about Australian political thought. Wayne, welcome back to the show.
Glad to be here.
Wayne, you've been on many times. You're a veteran of the political animals. And I think every time we've introduced you, we've said something different. And these days I get the guests to introduce themselves. So for listeners who don't know you or perhaps can't remember who you are from the last episode they listened to, who are you?
My name is Wayne Hudson. I'm an Australian intellectual historian. I have an illegal number of interests, and recently I've become interested in Australian political thought.
Which is, as it happens, the topic of this conversation with you, and I should just state for the benefit of listeners that you gave a keynote lecture at Charles Sturt University last year, and it was on the topic of the originality of Australian political thought, and I believe you are flirting with the idea of turning this into a book.
Oh, this will certainly be a book. The question is whether I live long enough to write the 16 volumes of it, but there will be a book, yes.
Or if you, it depends, you are writing about 16 books, I know, because we have adjacent offices and we've been in regular dialogue, I guess, almost daily dialogue for what, about 7, 8, 9 years now, so it's question of whether, if this is book number 8, whether you get to it or not, or maybe
well,
you could put it up the list.
Well, this book, I think, will be finished next year. I'm fairly certain about that, because you could go on forever with it. It's one of those topics that has no natural limit, so you have to create one.
Indeed, indeed. And this is going to be pioneering work. And when you write the pioneering work on such a big topic as Australian political thought, I mean, it could end up 1,000 pages, right?
Yes.
Okay. Enough about that. Let's dive in. And I would like to begin with a couple of definitional issues, which is actually where you began your lecture on this topic. And so the first definitional question is, what are we to understand by this notion of political thought in the context of Australian political thought?
Well, what I mean by it is the thematization of political concepts. I do not mean by it the ideas of politicians. Australian politicians have very little political thought because they don't have much thought about anything, really. But we have in Australia, quite contrary to what people believe, an enormous amount of political thought, and a lot of it is of very high value. So what I'm talking about is the development and thematization of political concepts, often of international importance in this country. I'm not talking about the kind of prattle on the mass media or the drivel that you're going to hear from our political class. I'm talking about serious conceptual work on politics done here.
And you make this really interesting point at the lecture, and I had the benefit of being in the audience at that lecture, and it was quite a thrilling lecture, I have to say, because you are quite a spectacular speaker for those who, well, I was going to say for those who are unaware, but I mean, you've been on the podcast so many times and you are a fan favorite. I get a lot of positive feedback. They always say, who's that guy who's like, you know, they don't understand the Greek and the German and the this and the that. So you're developing a reputation and people can see some of your highlights on YouTube. You mentioned something about the methodology of your approach, and you say specifically that you are looking at this from a philosophically informed global intellectual history methodology in contrast to the what you describe as the national intellectual history approach that dominates the historiography of Australia or in Australia.
Yes, okay. Well, Australian history is still in a very early phase. We haven't really arrived at an adequate history of Australia yet. There's no intellectual history of Australia been written. And a lot of what is written about Australia is written by people who know more about Australia than they do about anything else. And because of the history of settlement in this country, that leads to grotesque errors, because they assume the people they're writing about are as ignorant as they are. But it's not the case. The people who came to this country from various parts of the world brought a lot of cultural capital with them. And so I'm interested in looking at the political thought here with regard to what is available in the rest of the world. And when I make the claim for originality, of course, I'm comparing it with the rest of the world. The local tradition is to suggest that there's not much political thought here, and it's mainly derivative, and it's probably taken from the British. Well, I think that's just all lazy-headed and confused. But it's part of an anti-intellectual stream that is part of the Australian story, which you can find on both sides of politics, whereby you laugh at ideas, you laugh at people who know about ideas, and you talk about the importance of being practical and down to earth, without understanding, of course, that the political thought people in Australia in some cases were outstanding in the area of practical ideas and pragmatic political thought.
So on this, I want to dive deeper into this originality question, and you note that there are one or several prejudices, and you've just alluded to a couple there, when it comes to the history of Australian political thought. One is that it doesn't really exist in any substantial way, and I'm interested to know where you think that falsehood, which is what you contend it is, comes from. What is it in the Australian character or the characteristic of our history or sediment that led to that view that...
Well, it's not just in political thought, of course. I've written a major book on Australian religious thought, showing there was an enormous amount of that, and that was highly original too, but they said there was almost none before I wrote the book. And this arises in Australia because of the nature of the colonial settlement here, that people come to Australia who are not very prosperous and not very well informed in some cases, and then people come who have resentments against the United Kingdom of various kinds, and the result of this is a tendency to run anti-intellectualism as central to the Australian character. When a lot of the early attempts to define the character of Australian people use this anti-intellectual language. And of course, visiting Britons used it as well in a kind of condescending, sneering way. And they sometimes said, well, there's no ideas in Australia at all. Of course, these people in the colonies don't know anything. And in a way, the colonials had a tendency sometimes to agree with that from the other side. So they made it sound it was great that they had no ideas, but they agreed they did have no ideas. That's quite wrong. It's also got to do with the history of sectarianism in our country, because Australia was, until very recently, as sectarian as Northern Ireland, and it had catastrophic effects on our intellectual life, because while there was an enormous amount of cultural capital in Australia, it wasn't distributed. And so when you met at a party, you didn't talk ideas because it could lead to conflict. And you certainly didn't talk religious ideas. And political ideas were tricky in the same way, because they tended to come through religious sources. Now, again, modern Australia thinks it's secular. Well, it was never secular. It's not secular now. It was never secular at any time in the past. And secular in Australia, of course, meant common Christian. It doesn't now, but it did in the 19th century. And so in Australia, there was a tendency to have cultural capital, but to have it linked with religious groups. And since you weren't exchanging religious ideas with each other, the cultural capital wasn't shared. And hence you get the idea that there isn't much. So, for example, the average evangelical Christian was not really an expert on Italian theology or Catholic German theology, and certainly wouldn't have been reading the major books in Latin America written in Portuguese and Spanish. Catholic clergy in Australia may have known all those things. Now, you can see what a strange conversation that makes. And equally, the Catholics, of course, hadn't read the major German Protestant writers. So in Australia, the cultural capital was here, but it wasn't exchanged.
That's really fascinating and a very insightful observation, I have to say. Almost worthy of an entire podcast, that whole sectarian question, because it just looms so large and pops up all the time. But because there is this contemporary secular myth, I find a lot of people who might think of themselves as more secular totally underestimate assumes they actually know about the sectarianism, but it's just kind of written out of the history in generation and
below. The example that all Australians need to understand is that the Australian Labor Party at the moment is not prepared to commit to religious freedom in any serious way, and the Conservatives in Australia talk about it and don't do anything much either. And none of them really seem to understand that the Australian Labor Party was set up entirely by evangelical Christians and Catholics. It was entirely set up by people of very intense religious conviction, and that's where the social justice movement in Australia comes from. There is not any evidence for social justice in Australia coming from secularism.
Oof. Okay, there's another good topic for a podcast. We're going to have to, unfortunately, leave all these juicy topics by the wayside. Another interesting observation you made in the lecture regarding this originality point is the, notwithstanding this pervasive narrative that Australian political thought is sort of non-existent, or what does exist isn't really of any particular interest, there is also this other narrative, perhaps a minority narrative, that Australia, particularly during settlement in the 19th century, I guess, is this land of great experimentation. I know that Mill and some of his ilk, when it came to the colony in South Australia, saw it as this opportunity to try out all kinds of new social arrangements. People will know, if they're reasonably well-versed in Australian history, that Australia is a kind of pioneer in the globally in the labour movement, has a very early labour movement. It pioneers some things that may not actually meet your definition of political thought, but you know, South Australia is the first or one of the first jurisdictions to give women the vote. I think Australia or Australians, or I mean, are there Australians in this era? That's a vexed question. But people who are living on what becomes Australia pioneer the silent ballot, I believe. So there is evidence for political innovation, but again, are we to distinguish that from political thought, or is that overblown, this kind of idea that Australia is this land of amazing social experimentation?
I don't think the idea is overblown. I think it's true largely, but I think there's a tendency, again, not to work out where the ideas come from. There's a tendency to think Australians are practical, pragmatic people. Well, there's some truth in that. Of course, we know that's in many ways very, very true, but how did they get to be pragmatic, practical people? Well, you could say convicts are practical in certain areas of organised crime. but the practicism in Australia is not anti-intellectual. It's just the historians that are anti-intellectual. So when you get these amazing developments in Australia, they actually come from someone and they come from somewhere. And one of the problems is that Australians have this idea that they are of British origin, and that there were colonies in Australia. Well, I can't discuss that today, but the whole idea of the colonial nature of Australia, which is now almost dominant among younger historians, is based on extreme ignorance, of course, about the history of law, the history of British law, and the history of empire. These are not things these people study. They study Australian history. Well, great, but if you don't know about the world, your Australian history is going to be fairly stupid. So in order to clarify all this, we have to say, well, which ideas, where did they come from and who had them? And that, of course, is something that I'm trying to do in the book. But to do it, I have to look at about 40 to 60 well-known Australians and have a look at what they did know and what the influences really were. And, of course, it's full of amazing surprises. And one of the surprises that's answering your question is that the Australians, of course, were often very well informed about a foreign country. And of course, we don't know which foreign country until we look. So just to give you two obvious examples, one of the most important figures in Australian political thought is David Syme in Melbourne. He's the father of protection. Well, what you need to know is that David Syme studied in Germany and had an expert knowledge of the German philosopher Fichte. No Australian historian except me, I think, could give a lecture on Fichte's political philosophy. But the crucial figure David Syme in Australian political history studied Fichte in Germany and knew every word in German. Now, that illustrates what I'm saying. So ignorance of the foreign leads to underestimating originality here and attributing it to the wrong sources. Now, I can give many, many, many more examples from different biases and different points of view. If you want to take the history of Catholicism in Australia, there is a link between social justice in Australia and Catholic influence. That's been known for a very long time. What isn't known is that there's a link between the Catholic influence and the Italian philosopher Rosmini. Well, no Australian historian has really heard of Rosmini and certainly hasn't read his 15 volumes in Italian. But of course, the founding figures of social justice in Australia did know about Rosmini and they did have the volumes on the wall. Now, this is the point. Practical people, pragmatic people, original people. Yes, but they know about something. And what we have to ask over and over again, what is it? Now, it could be, for example, anarchism in Bulgaria. Well, you never heard of that in your life. No, of course not. But Australian anarchism is influenced by Bulgarian anarchism because they come here to Melbourne. You want to talk about communism, a main theme in Australian political thought. Well, yes, but people who talked about communism in Australia who knew anything knew about somewhere. And of course, the early Soviet Union sent political people to organize the Communist Party in Australia. The leaders of the Communist Party in Australia studied Marxism in China, not in Russia, not in Britain, in China. So again, they knew about an actual country setting up a successful socialist society. Mm. And this story goes on and on. And you can take another example. Everybody knows there's a National Party in Australia. Everyone knows that. Well, where does the ideology of the National Party come from? Oh, well, it comes from looking at sheep and cattle and on a hot day. Well, this is all absolute nonsense. It comes from American populism. It's an import from the United States of America. That's where it comes from. And what about other aspects of Australian progressivism, because progressivism was enormous in Melbourne and has had a great influence on the whole social structure of Australia. Well, it partly comes from American progressivism. But as Marilyn Lake has shown in an absolutely brilliant book, the Australians were more radical than the Americans, and the Americans got a lot of their stuff from us. So now you see my argument not only shows foreign influencing us, but allows me to argue we influence foreign. And that's entirely missing in the national history. I mean, no one listening to this podcast will know that many of the institutions of South Korea come from Presbyterians in Canberra. So this is not a one-way thing. Mm. And it goes back to this drivel about colonialism and empire, because, of course, the whole point about being the kind of society we were in an international empire is that you can move around it. Mm. And you have citizenship in the 19th century and for much of the 20th century, over about a quarter of the world. So when you arrive in India, you don't get off the boat and say, I'm from Australia and this is India and I've been learning your 18 languages. You get off the boat with a passport saying you're British, and so you're actually a powerful person in India. And many people listening will not know that Australia provided the governorship of Bengal.
So this is really interesting, Wayne. It sounds like, I mean, that empire point just seems so important to me, because the historical prejudice at work here, it seems, is to think, perhaps influenced by this famous notion of the tyranny of distance, that the colonies on the continent of Australia in the 19th century are somehow cut off from the rest of the world. But of course, you're saying that Australia was integrated into this empire, and we don't have any tangible experience of what it's like to live in an empire these days, whereas that has been the experience of human beings.
I would go even further and say that the current literature about colonialism, which again is a dominant theme, is written by people who don't know the history of empire and couldn't discuss any major empire in the ancient world. Mm. They've picked up political jargon from left-wing publications. And of course, they haven't read Marx, because to read Marx, you need a lot of philosophical German. He's a great genius and he's a very outstanding thinker, but you can't read him in a Russian mistranslation kind of thing, which is what they've done. And so a kind of fifth-rate understanding of Marx by people who think they're on the left, who I would call neo-fascists, are promoting wrong ideas about colonial settlement in Australia. I'm not even happy about the idea that there were Australian colonies. That also needs to be carefully studied. Most Australians don't realize that in the 19th century, these so-called colonies were independent states with their own armies and their own currencies. Mm. Now, as soon as you begin to get that, you begin to see, oh, there's a whole history that has to be written or is written that hasn't been absorbed. Mm. In some cases, it has been written. It's just that it hasn't got into the minds of many people talking about Australian history.
Yeah, I think another blind spot actually is that we smooth over the level of diversity that were amongst, even right to the First Fleet.
Yes.
And we forget that we kind of treat it like there's this concept of British and this uniform people arrive. But of course, even the English come from different parts of England. They're different classes. You've got religious differences.
Yes.
And throughout the 19th century, we get Chinese. There's obviously the very diverse indigenous population. Germans start coming to South Australia. And it's actually, it's only British in a very simple sense in a way.
Well, the point I was trying to make, reasserting it again, what comes to Australia is empire.
Yeah.
It's not the British who come here, it's the empire. Mm. And people who come here, who are certainly in a vague sense British, have in some cases been in the Caribbean or in India. Yeah. And they may be Irish, or they may be Scottish, or they may be Welsh. They can be all kinds of, in crucial cases, they come from Cornwall. Mm. And some of them seem to have spoken Cornish. This British thing is a kind of latter-day mythology. They would have seen themselves as British, but in the same sort of sense that someone in Palestine, like Paul of Tarsus, would have seen himself as Roman. Mm. He didn't think he was Roman in the sense of a citizen of the city of Rome, in a simple sense. Yeah. But Australians, historically, the European Australians, were people of a global empire. And that meant they had very close connections with other parts of the world. And the case that's really outstanding here is feminism, which is very important in Australia and has a brilliant history. Recently, Beata Goldman's wonderful work has been rediscovered and correctly emphasised. But what's forgotten is that feminists in Australia were again part of empire. And so they went all over the world, thank you. Novelists with almost no money went to London, had no problem at all, because as empire people, they were put up by British feminists. And, of course, large numbers of Australians studied in other parts of the world, and that was also connected to this empire connection. I'm not defending empire. That's a totally different argument. Or colonisation, that's another argument. But I am saying to look at Australia as though we were South America is radically wrongheaded. Mm. This was a vastly different case. And the key to it is British legal history, which until about 1960, Australians knew. Now they don't know. But the Australians knew it. And I could talk later, if you want, about Menzies, because people, again, have completely forgotten what Menzies would have known. He would have known nothing about the history of Japan or China. Mm. He knew everything about the history of British constitutional history because he learned it at university. I did it as well. I won the prize in constitutional law. What was constitutional law when I was a lawyer? It was British constitutional law. We didn't even mention Australia in that course once.
Mm, fascinating. I mean, that also just makes you realise that the sort of empire, settlement, colonisation, I know you're problematising these terms, and I understand your point. You're not making a value judgment. You're just saying we haven't quite got the yes. full texture
yes.
Right, because it is a very complex phenomenon. And this is something that's always struck me, because I began my career at the my public service career at the what was then the Department of Immigration and Multicultural Affairs. And it was fascinating to learn that the very notion of Australian citizen emerges quite late. I mean, the Australian Citizenship Act, I think, comes up in the 40s, and then it's only, I think, in the 80s where British citizens resident in Australia, there was some kind of, there was still a category where a British citizen could had an automatic kind of entitlement to live in Australia. And so my point is that we have this myth, really, that in 1901 we kind of become an independent country. But and I thought of this because of your point, that you're what, studying in the 60s at University of Sydney doing law or whenever it was, and still there's this kind of emphasis on British constitution.
When I went to China for the first time in 1968, in the middle of the Cultural Revolution, was trained by the Red Guards. I didn't stay with the Red Guards, but I was forced to study Mao's thought by the Red Guards, and my passport said British subject.
That's the point I was trying to
make. Yeah. In 1968, as late as that, and when we got to Beijing, a group of young Australians, we were taken out to a wonderful Beijing dinner by the British diplomatic staff.
As British because subjects.
Because they're as British subjects.
Because this would have been, was this before, it would have been before Gough Whitlam recognised China, and we, so presumably we didn't have an embassy.
No, we had no embassy there. No.
And so the interesting thing is that I guess the point I'm drawing out is an added complexity, which is that the evolution of an Australian identity, legal, spiritual, whatever you want to call it, is a kind of long iterative process that I would argue hasn't even come to full fruition, because it evolves slowly across the whole 20th century. And I think only now we're trying to reckon with the Indigenous element, and I expect actually that process could take a century as well, and that at the end of this century there will be a new Australian identity that comes to some kind of agreed narrative about settlement. Whether it's how historically accurate is another matter, because national identities are not
usually
scientific, but the point is that it's not like you can point to a date and a time where the empire element disappears. And so that's a very long way of just saying that this point is just so important, because the empire thing is a kind of factor in a way all the way up until relatively recently. That's the point I'm
trying
to make.
Yes, I think it's important to say to everybody that Australia is a nation state that hasn't completed its nation state formation process.
I like that.
And the nationalists were right about this. I mean, I'm often saying critical things about Australian nationalist historians, as most people do now, because we can now see that they were racist and extremely prejudicial about a whole range of questions. But they were right to think that we ought to have a vision of what Australia's about, and we ought to be able to say what is original and new about our country, and we ought to have a sense of our task in the world that reflects our geography and isn't stuck in either the United Kingdom or Dublin. Hmm. But the people who wrote this history were themselves in some ways stuck in the United Kingdom and Dublin. That's part of the paradox of Australian nationalism. So we do need a nation formation process now. And the whole thing about the Indigenous is hugely important, because it tells us something pathological about our whole history that we didn't see it till so late. Mm. And I would say we didn't see other things, not just the Indigenous. Yeah. If you look at the Second World War, it's very difficult to think that we had a mature understanding of Japan and Japan's objectives in the Pacific. We did not. The idea that we understood anything about South Africa when we sent our people to kill the Dutch in South Africa, again, was an example of extraordinary false consciousness. So a big part of the Australian story is false consciousness. Today I'm talking about the good side, if you like. But there's a negative side, where we did not pick up our geography, we did not master essential facts about the history of where we are in the world.
I mean, I think a quintessential example of this is the Anzac mythology, because it's always struck me as a really fascinating thing to think that a on the one hand, a completely pointless military campaign, which is decided by the British, not the Australian Army, but the army's fighting as part of the empire, and that we know that a lot of the soldiers were fighting for King and the British Empire, not this thing called Australia necessarily, but also, of course, it's a complete defeat, and that becomes, in some people's eyes, the kind of founding myth of Australia, a defeat in a really pointless war against the people we had nothing, really no beef with, decided by British military commanders. In a way, again, just illustrates this point of, so that this is what, 1915 is the Gallipoli. And again, that tells you, it problematizes your whole view of Australia is.
It makes the point that we haven't done the nation formation process and we need to do it in a whole variety of areas, because the studies actually show that the soldiers who were at Gallipoli wrote in their letters back to their families about going home. And in talking about going home, they didn't mean Australia, they meant Britain.
Fascinating.
And that's part of the story. And of course, the whole, you want to be positive. One of the things the Australians have done that I think is outstandingly good is that they've recognised this catastrophe and become very friendly with Turkey and have recognised that we were not on the right side morally. And it's a sign of our development as a people, because you wouldn't have been able to say that in the press at the time.
I dare say some of those soldiers probably would be surprised that 100 years later, people like me would fall in love with Turkish pide and be able to eat it at one of dozens and dozens, probably hundreds of Turkish restaurants.
One of the most exciting things about multiculturalism in Australia is it's changed all of the food, and the food's become better in every way. In Australia, the coffee shop was probably the biggest development in the last 30 years, because people sit down and talk, and they talk about almost everything and about most of the world.
Yeah.
But when I was a child, they didn't know where most of the world was. When I was called up to fight in the Vietnam War, my father brought home a map and put it on the table and said, "Where is Vietnam?"
Wow. Yeah, yeah.
So we've gone off our topic a bit.
Well, no, but the broad topic is Australia. We'll get back to political thought specifically, and just to preempt the angry letters, I'm not saying that the soldiers that fought in Gallipoli didn't show extreme valor and heroism. You can do that in a pointless war too, and I'm not trivializing the sacrifice. I'm just pointing out, as an Australian, it's a strange foundational myth. You can contrast it with the American Revolution, which was successful for starters, and which definitely tangibly is connected to the emergence of America as an independent nation. I find the fact that so much emphasis has been put on Anzac says something. In a way, it illustrates the whole point that that this is a very novel case, Australia, and I don't think we haven't quite understood the right historical categories to even understand it.
It also shows you the other crucial thought, that we don't have the American parallels, you see, and why don't we have them? And we have a constitution, but we have no reverence for the constitution. There are no
Australians. And partly modelled on the American constitution.
There are no originalists in Australia. This is not... committing to constitution doesn't make you Australian in ordinary people's understanding. Mm. And if you start citing sections, they don't know what the sections are. And they certainly haven't read it or thought about it in any way. This is not true in the United States. It's a primary religious document in America. We have no sense of our relationship to the French Revolution. The French Revolution was not important in Australian political thought. Well, in the United States, the French Revolution is enormously important because the Republic is founded by people who are aware of the Revolution and in one case go there. There's a huge... So our non-Americanness is one of the results of this kind of research. It shows that we're much less like the United States than we now think. We have a radically different conceptual system, a radically different approach to politics, and I would say very different problems. Mm. Both societies have great virtues and great problems, but our problems are different.
And a point on the British side that I've really learnt from you, because you rightly emphasise this, is the... To understand Australia, you have to be very attentive to what doesn't come here from the UK, because a lot of things don't come here, like a landed aristocracy, like an established church, and the list goes on. And sometimes I think there's a temptation to just assume, okay, British colony, it must.
I think that
everything must have been imported in some form from.
Yes, I think that's a point we might stress. One of the problems in studying Australian political thought is that there's a tendency for people to assume, A, that the British material came, B, that the Australians understood it in the British way, and a very strong tendency to assume that the words in Australian English have the same meaning as in British English. But in the 17th century, that's absolutely not true. And one of the things in Australia that's startling is the relatively weak reception of John Locke, who is enormously important in the United States, but not here in the same way. And when Australians read 17th century texts, they are not at all good at understanding the meaning of the English, because it's not a language that's known in this country or spoken in this country. And although there were Australian intellectuals with a lot of Latin and Greek, they were fairly small in number. And there's a tendency for Australians in reading any British text not to hear the Greek and Latin undertone, and also not to hear the French undertone, because someone writing serious intellectual work in Britain will certainly have French and may have... English have a tendency to say they don't speak any foreign languages, but having spent a long time there, I can assure you very often they have half a dozen and are likely perhaps to know Russian, which you're not expecting, and maybe Japanese or Chinese as well. So Australians have the wrong idea about the reception of the British culture. They think that it was understood here in the same way. There's a large literature saying that utilitarianism was crucial for the foundation of Australia, and there's a little bit of truth in that, but not too much. And the general assumption is that utilitarian ideas were understood here as they were in England. But I'm sure I can show you that passages were taken from utilitarian writers and interpreted here as they would not have been interpreted in England. Mill was an enormous influence in Australia, greater in my view than Bentham, but very few Australians would have understood anything Mill wrote in Mill's sense, because Mill could have discussed it Turkey in great detail. Mill knew about every country in Europe. He had an enormous range of knowledge of India through the family. The Australian reading Mill gets the English words, but not their international meaning.
Yeah, fascinating. Now, one of the things I have pulled out from your lecture, and I know this will be a major theme of the book, is you do identify, this is going back to this original point, this notion of originality. You do point to some of the things that are original, and we've sprinkled some here and there, but I would like to go through this relatively short list, because I found this really illuminating, and I could all of them immediately resonated with me. And I've thought a lot about this, but been unable to articulate exactly where the fault lines are that separate Australia, particularly from the US and the UK. Yes. So I'll run through them and name them, and then it'd be interesting if you could just tease them out a little bit. So the first one is you, and this has come up already, but there is a preference for pragmatism over political principles.
Yes. The key point there is that in the United States, the policy that we're advocating is pragmatic, is grounded in our political principles. Mm. Australians don't ground policy in political principles.
Okay, fascinating.
It's a huge difference.
Yeah, the other one is, and you mentioned the absence of Locke here as a major influence vis-a-vis America, but you add a bit of detail, which is interesting, and I would like to hear a bit more about this, that what we miss is Lockean natural law.
Yes.
Or a strong doctrine of the natural rights of the individual. But what you do find in Australia is a deep sympathy for natural justice. And of course, yes. We don't have a Bill of Rights here. Even the UK has a Bill of Rights.
Exactly.
And most liberal, Western liberal democracies, I think, do have a Bill of Rights. There is something like that at the state and territory jurisdiction. But we don't have a strong culture of right. Like our... In America, rights and individual rights and their clash and the resolution of tensions between rights is such a major theme of political debate there, whereas here it's very absent. Even on the progressive side, it's not that our political discourse doesn't seem to orbit around the notion of individual rights.
Well, there are several reasons for that. But two major reasons, is that Australian thinking about rights and social policy more generally is enormously influenced by Scottish idealism, which is a Presbyterian tendency. And Scottish idealism does not center on the rights of the individual, but on the social good. And that's had enormous influence in our country. The Scottish influence, all the universities in Australia originally were Scottish. The influence here has been enormous from the Scottish idealist tradition. So although Australians like to think that they're materialists, historically they were not materialists, they were Scottish idealists. And as part of that, there was a primacy of social right over individual right. And it occurs in people who were from Scotland and influenced by Scotland. And they promoted social right here, which is not an American concept at all. And then there was a huge influence here, obviously, of the Catholic population, particularly the Irish population. Mm. And the Australian Catholic tradition emphasized, of course, Catholic natural law. Mm. But Catholic natural law is not based on individual right. It's based on what you have to do because it's the law of God given to the universe. It is not derived from individuals and their choices. In fact, you could say it's sometimes insensitive to the rights of individuals. So again, that was a huge influence here. But Catholic natural law did inspire a lot of the social and political doctrine in Australia because you had to do things because they were right. Mm. But right there means, as in natural law in the Catholic, and you could add to the Catholic there, also Protestant natural law, which was also a factor in Australia. But in the United States, this is nowhere near as important because while there are Catholics, they are not wealthy for most of the history of the country. They're in certain parts of the country, and they're not dominant in the Northeast. The country is really controlled from the Northeast, not from Maryland or from the South. Then a third factor is the influence of German thought here, and I've already mentioned that. Australians are quite insensitive to the degree to which they are actually influenced by German concepts. But everybody knows, of course, that there was a reception of British idealism and Scottish idealism here in various ways. And there was considerable interest in Germany as a successful country. I won't go into that again. But the German tendency, again, is not to ground the natural law in the rights of an individual. Germany is not Locke country. I'm not saying that Locke wasn't important here, but I'm saying he didn't have the same impact as in the US. And that's an enormous difference in the cases.
That's really interesting. I want to just touch on this Catholic issue because I'm more and more struck by this.
And Anglican, it wasn't just Catholic.
Yeah.
See, you've got to remember there were also a very great tradition of high Anglicanism.
Yeah.
People forget it now because they've almost gone now.
Yeah.
But in Australia, there were vast numbers of high church Anglicans, particularly in hot parts of Australia.
Yeah.
And these were people who knew the church fathers in Greek. These were people who were very well aware of medieval theological debates. Yeah. And some of the preference for a doctrine of natural law in Australia also comes from Anglican sources. Mm. And you mentioned Anzac before, but it's virtually certain that Anzac is invented by the Anglo-Catholics in Australia.
So
we have this delusion that we're a secular materialistic lot that are very pragmatic and practical.
Yeah.
Well, I think I can prove to you beyond any doubt at all that the country is made essentially by Christians.
Yeah.
And these Christians know a lot more than you're expecting. They're a lot better educated than you're imagining.
Yeah.
They know foreign languages. And they are bringing European ideas here, not only British ideas.
Yeah, that's a good point. The religious sensibility of Anzac that a lot of non-religious Australians are probably unaware of is not accidental. It's quite conscious. But what I want to get you to say something more about the Catholic element, because in my, you know, I had the privilege of going to New Zealand a couple of times last year. And, you know, what I discovered there was that Catholicism is just not nearly as big a factor in the profile of their settlement, and it hasn't been the big political influence that it has in Australia. Obviously, it's a much smaller proportionally minority in the US, which it has the feel of a much more Protestant country, and everyone knows about the Puritan settlers and the this and that. And, of course, in the US, in England and even in Scotland, Catholics are kind of repressed for quite a period after the, the Elizabethan era, after the kind of two sides dominate for a part of time. So the point I want to make, and you can disabuse me, you can refine, clarify, is, and when I meet English, Kiwis, and Americans, now I know Canada's a special case because it's got Quebec, but set that aside for a second, and it's perhaps there are similarities there because there originally was this Irish ethnic element to Catholicism, but they're shocked when I tell them that the Catholic Church is the largest church today in Australia, and that we are, but this is the point I'm coming to, could you say that we are the most Catholic Anglo country anywhere in the world, in the sense that and I know migration is played a role more recently in Catholic numbers, but it's been a major social, cultural, political force in this country in a way that's very unusual for Anglo-Saxon countries.
We need, I think, to break it down into three different things and not to blur them in a way. I mean, one thing is laity. Now, obviously, there were, from the beginnings, Catholic laity here and different proportions to New Zealand, many more here, and a lot of very poor Irish came Australia. And that's why the Labour Party in its early days is heavily influenced by the Irish Catholic laity. But these people, the lay Catholics, didn't have very much education at all. In fact, one of the goals of the religious orders was to raise them up out of a fairly degraded condition and make them middle-class successful people, which they then did. And these people, who are Catholic by ethnicity, even by religion, I think is a bit of a push. They may not be religious in a sense you want to push too hard, but they come from a country that's ethnically Catholic. So you're Italian, so you're Catholic. Not that you're Catholic and Italian. These people, because they're poor, have a certain sympathy for the underdog and a certain sympathy for social justice measures. That's a factor in the Australian story. Absolutely it is. But then there are the clergy and the bishops, and they're an entirely different story. The Australian bishops are educated in Rome. They are fluent in Italian and they do all their exams in Latin. So these are now we have the empire story again, only this time it's the Roman Catholic Empire, not the British Empire. So we had two empires here. And so the bishops in Australia are, in a certain way, not in a very theological way, but in a certain way, they're quite highly educated people in that they know things that other Australians don't. And because of their linguistic formation, they can, for example, read books in Italian without any problem. They're likely to have some French. They may also speak German. A lot of the Australian bishops now have five or six languages. This is not the case of the Protestants. So there's a big linguistic gap. So the second group, the upper clergy, are a factor here because they are much better educated. Mannix is a huge factor in the whole political history of Australia. Well, Mannix is an aristocrat from Ireland. He's professor of ethics at Maynooth. And he's very sympathetic to Germany in the First World War and gets into trouble. But the reason he's sympathetic to Germany is not a religious reason. It's that he probably has German. and maybe other European languages. The Irish always, of course, had much more European language than the French, and looked down on the British as sort of an inferior, degraded lot, really. And that's another factor in Australia. So there is, on the higher clergy side, a lot of knowledge of Europe. And then there are religious orders. Now, in New Zealand, religious orders are not important. There are no major religious orders in New Zealand. The Jesuits don't go there. In Australia, the Jesuits educate these poor Catholics to become rich Catholics. And they provide a large number of the people who run the Foreign Service here. And they are important in almost every aspect of Australian life, because the people they educate are pretty good at what they do and are formidable. And so they tend to rise to the top. And this isn't a religious point. It's not that they're running around saying, you know, I'm a Roman Catholic and I'm Jesuit educated. But they're going to have sympathies on certain questions that are historically different. For example, they will know something about Italy, maybe not much, but it's very likely they've been there. Chances of them having been there very high. They may certainly have been to France. They probably speak some French. They may read some Italian. I have people in my family, young Australians now, who read Italian and speak Italian fluently, which wouldn't be true of a Protestant family, you see. And then the religious orders have a huge influence in bringing European knowledges to Australia. So if you're an order of nuns, you may seem to be harmless to everybody and to do nothing except, you know, some helping some old alcoholics or something. But the founder of your order is quite likely to be French or Italian. And you'll have a mother house in those countries. Mm. And if you're in the order and you're really quite talented, you will be educated in Europe. One of my closest friends at university was professor of medicine at Sydney University. She was a Dominican nun. She had studied in Italy. She had French, Italian, and German, and Latin, and a bit of Hebrew. Now, this was a factor in Australia. The religious orders are important here because they produce people who have international knowledges that other Australians do not have. Again, it's the exchange of knowledge thing. It's not just that the knowledge is here, but it isn't exchanged. Mm. So if you've gone to Moore College in Sydney and you're a very active evangelical of some sort, in the past, particularly in the days of Broughton Knox, and I knew Broughton very well, they didn't mix really with the Catholics except one day of the year, and they didn't have language knowledges in common. If you discuss contemporary Italian poetry, they couldn't do that. They weren't reading that. Well, the Catholics certainly could. Upper clergy had spent time in Italy. And, of course, people from European countries came and visited religious orders and so on and so on and so on. So part of the answer to all this is that there was a multiple Catholic influence. There were the poor Catholics influencing social progressive movements because they were poor. That's less true now. They're more inclined now to be in the Liberal Party because they're not poor anymore. Yes. Then there's an influence of the religious orders, which has not been properly studied. But I think particularly the Christian Brothers were very important because they raised up very poor people to be middle class. Now, some of those middle class people would be in government all over Australia even now. Mm. It's a big factor. And they're not, I wouldn't say they were radically left in any way. They weren't given leftist ideas, but they would have been given ideas about the basic wage and a home for every Australian family. And a lot of what, say, the Australian Liberal Party now says, I think these kids would have heard at school from Christian Brothers. Of course, and among the Christian Brothers, there would have been Irish, born in Ireland, Irish. Yeah. So again, there are links back to Europe through the religious factor.
Yeah. Speaking of the religious factor, another one of the points of originality that you identify is a tendency to exclude explicit religion from our political life while having an enthusiastic acceptance of secular religion in military contexts. And we've already talked about ANZAC, but what I'm very curious about this instinct, if that's the right word, because it is true on the one hand. I would actually bring in the indigenous element here, because I think, and I don't even have the language for this, but things like acknowledgement to country, welcome to country, smoking ceremonies, and what I think is an evolving kind of civil religion for a lot of non-indigenous people, for a country that has this self-perception of being at the most secular end of the spectrum globally, I've been really surprised and intrigued by the rapid adoption of new kind of rituals and spirituality and a kind of respect for spirituality. And I wonder if you are able to offer a hypothesis on how these two characteristics fit into the Australian temperament?
There are two things you have to say, not one. The first thing, and I don't say this in this book, but I did say it in Religious Thought, Australia is characterized by sacred secularity.
So what happens
in Australia is that they withdraw from the public religion factor a little bit, not totally, but they go from being virtually a country that has the Church of England as the state church to being a country that sees itself as having religions but not being overwhelmingly committed to historical religion of a particular kind. But then, unlike other countries, they develop sacred secularity. And that is a major feature of Australian institutional formation, and that continues right until now. And again, there are contrasts with the United States, where there is a lot more skepticism about things that we regard as quasi-sacral. I mean, if you said that we should abolish the basic wage, Australians would rise up in arms. Mm. If you said that superannuation was a wicked, dangerous communist practice, Australians would rise up in arms. If you said you shouldn't have drink alcohol laws in Australia, it's a contrast to the freedom of the individual, Australians would rise up in arms. Now, you see the parallels with the US. So we have a lot of sacred secularity. But because we haven't finished our nation formation process, we have an inner vacuum. We don't really know who we are. And in the past, that was less of a problem because Australians didn't really travel much. The elite traveled, but ordinary Australians might have driven around Australia, they might have gone to New Zealand, sometimes they went, you know, to New Guinea or something like that, but they certainly didn't go to Tibet. I mean, in my generation, people I knew as a child had not been to Tibet, and they certainly hadn't been to Moscow, and they certainly hadn't been to Patagonia. Well, now I know enormous numbers of Australians have been to lots of these places. So with the greater travel, there comes a greater awareness of the complexities of the world. And this produces a feeling that we should have a story to tell and a song to sing. And there's a tendency, they used to try to do the old Australian nationalist stuff. They still sometimes do, but it doesn't work. I mean, if you sing Advance Australia Fair, we don't believe a word of it. This is not us. This is some colonial relic that we don't want to have as our national anthem. And then in other areas too, there's stuff from the past. McKellar's poetry, it still gets quoted, but I don't think anybody really feels that that sort of stuff is what we really think. And Indigenous people feel insulted by this kind of thing. So I think what's happening now is an attempt to complete the nation formation process, a very definite attempt to put the sacral right at the centre of it, which is surprising to secularists but consistent with Anzac Day and the historical past. Mm. In a way, I'd say we always did it. It's just we did it in other ways before. Now we're doing it in new ways. And it will become the identity of the nation, even though it involves an element of historical misunderstanding, I think. I think the attempt to make us New Zealand is entirely wrongheaded for reasons you give. I mean, the Indigenous Australia are not similar to the Maori. It's not a similar story at all. The Maori were an empire before they came to New Zealand. They were warlike. The Indigenous story is entirely different, and in fact, in many ways, unique in the entire world. And we still haven't spent enough time studying it and understanding it, because it's wrong to treat Australian Indigenous in a category of Indigenous that applies to everyone, or to start comparing them with the Inuit in Canada. I mean, this is madness. This is a people like no other, with a history like no other, and their originality needs studying, as does white Australia's originality.
And actually, I've long thought that the uniqueness of our Indigenous peoples and their interaction with European settlers is part of the uniqueness of the Australian story, even though we are wrestling with it at the moment. And like, I think all national identity is a mixture of fact and fiction. I don't think there's any nation on the planet, ancient or modern, that doesn't have that mix. And I don't necessarily think that is a bad thing, because I think humans or cultures have myth. Myth can be a powerful way of understanding the world, in a sense, if you can separate facticity from truth, if I can put it that way, as in theological myths have the potential to convey some of the most profound truths that we couldn't sort of articulate in scientific fact, for example. Anyway, that's beside the point. But I think this is missing from the whole debate at the moment about the Indigenous question, is this failure to recognise that wherever this lands, I think it will rightly make Australia more unique, which does reflect the real historical story, if I can put it that way.
I think there's a lot in that. The two points are that, of course, if you turn to the indigenous, you're committed to spirituality.
Yeah, they ain't a secular people.
Which secular Australia doesn't much like and is beginning to realise it's going to have to like. That's a huge change in our country.
But I have, just to put a real pin in that, I mean, I have been at events where I've seen a white person trash the Christian institutions in Australia whilst lauding Indigenous Australia and trashing the religious stuff because of their spiritual, religious, mythological element without any sense of irony that the people that this person worships are deeply religious in our sense, not a category of thought in their sense, or you could use spirituality, but these aren't secular scientists
there is a problem in it, and the problem is that the indigenous spirituality is the spirituality of the land, and they're not nationalists, you see.
Yeah.
And it's not the sort of stuff that was important for European Australia.
Yeah.
And it's a spirituality of land, but the land is alive and is full of dead people who come out at night. Now, this is a very radical revision of the Australian imaginary, and it does create the problem, of course, that probably our imaginary in the long term can't be an imaginary of land. This is one of the difficulties, because obviously we all live within 15 minutes or an hour and a half of the sea, and you could say that this is a country of the sea more than the land. And the indigenous don't have any significant mythology
sea. That's one of the most urbanised countries, states
so
on the planet.
The new Australian identity that is emerging through these, I would say, half-secularised white intelligentsias, is one that doesn't actually fit the realities of the country, the settlement pattern of the country. And, of course, it makes no sense at all in Asia.
Mm-hmm.
And it means they can't do Asia and they can't do China. So the big challenge is really how we will relate to the new world hegemon. And the answer is they can't at all.
Mm-hmm.
And none of these people speak a word of Chinese. Mm-hmm. There are some Chinese now selling Indigenous Australia to the Australians. That is happening all over the country. But there's no serious engagement with China at all in Australia is catastrophically bad. There's no understanding the federal parliament of China at all. And to understand China, you have to embrace thousands of years of civilization and all the values that go with it. Whereas this intelligentsia in Australia is trying to reject all civilization, particularly European, when they're going to, if they're not careful, become a state of China. The chances of the Australian nation state surviving are not high.
Wow, almost want to just ditch the show and tackle that question. Maybe we'll do that for our next episode, because I have heard some of your provocative views on that, and you have spent considerable time in China. You do know a bit.
Well, I push the China thing because it corrects illusions Australians have.
Mm.
There are people in Australia who push the China thing, and that's all they say. Well, that's not helpful either. I mean, of course, we have to know about our own country and our own land and the indigenous people. Of course, that's right.
Yeah.
And we have to know something about Europe, because Europe's important for the entire world.
Yeah.
And we have to know about the United States. The knowledge of the United States in Australia is tragic.
Yeah.
I mean, most Australians couldn't do an easy exam on American history.
No, well, it's a Hollywood.
Apart from Mills, I don't know whether anyone in the federal parliament could pass an exam on American history. This, again, is absolutely moronic. We have to know world.
I think we have a Hollywood version of America, which is basically most people's understanding of that very diverse and complex and interesting country is refracted through Hollywood movies, which I realise will make some of my US listeners wince, but that's the power,
it's the cultural power of
Hollywood. But I take your point, and I would re-articulate it like this, that there is some possibility that we spend all of this time internally focused, wrestling with our what is a very vexed history, and we haven't come to terms with it yet, and we're trying to work out a way of reckoning with it without sort of flagellating ourselves to death and, you know, coming out the other side with some kind of future-oriented story, only to find out that we're living in a Chinese world and that that whole process was kind of irrelevant and immaterial in the end, because we may all, in the end, have to focus on Chinese civilization as a way of understanding the world that we live in. You do mention, well, you do note that Australia has an enthusiasm for militarism in the form of committing troops to foreign wars. And I think that's definitely true. But the question is, why do we have this, why do we fight, why have we fought more wars in more distant lands over the last 123 years than most states on the planet, particularly for a kind of country our size and so remote from where most of these conflicts are?
Yes. Well, I don't have a complete answer to that at all. It is partly a social sexual pathology, I think.
Sorry, did you say social sexual?
Yes, there's something very sick about it. You see it obviously dramatically in the case of the Vietnam War and the Korean War. In both cases, we sent people and lost people and killed people. And we didn't understand almost anything about the realities of Vietnam. I would say that both political parties, which said opposite things, were totally deluded. I could talk about that for a long, long time, but most Australians are convinced that the war in Vietnam had nothing to do with China, and then Mr. Santa Maria believed it was a Russian plot and that the Russians were taking over the world. And, you know, this is all absolute nonsense. We knew nothing about the war in Vietnam, including our experts. Our understanding of the Chinese role was non-existent. We didn't know anything much about Korea either, frankly. And even now, the number of Australians who've been to North Korea is fairly small, probably about 80 of them. We don't really show, and I say that in the document, significant interest in foreign peoples. We bring them here. We accept a bit of their culture when they come, but we don't study the places they came from. So if you say there's a war in Yemen, well, people know that. But what is it about? They don't know. And who are the Yemenis? They don't know. And so part of our pathology as an emerging nation state is that we do not understand the world we're in. And that leads us to, I call a social sexual pathology about foreign wars. Originally, of course, we fought in foreign wars because we felt it was the only way to guarantee our own long-term security. We fought for the British because the British would protect us and no one else would. And we didn't even consider the justice of the cause. If England was in it, we were in it. I think that's quite fair. And then we transferred the same crazy social sexual pathology to the Americans and decided that, because we decided that the Japanese were trying to invade us in the Second World War, evidence for that's very small. And then we decided the Americans had saved us, which is true in a certain way. And then we decided they'd do it again. And so if the Americans had asked us to attack Patagonia, I can imagine Australians sending soldiers and boats. That's why the boat issue this week is so important. Yeah. The government has rightly seen, I think, that sending a boat to the Middle East at the moment is not a good idea, and that the AUKUS agreement cannot be an agreement to support the United States in all of its crazy international adventures.
So maybe what this boils down to is a unique level of insecurity, like a profound sense of being isolated and vulnerable and surrounded by potential enemies. Perhaps that is a unique Australian.
I think it's true, but again, the Australians know it in a sort of vague way and don't know it literally. They don't realise. I mean, yeah. I don't think Australians realise that Indonesia is 20 minutes from Darwin.
Yeah.
I don't think they realise how easy it would be for a naval force to land on our coast.
Yeah. And it's one of the largest countries on the planet.
And we have no way of defending our coastline. We have our defence arrangements are semi-pathetic. It is a part of the Australian story, I think, is an inability to really relate to the part of the world we are and to think in military terms about that in ways that aren't crazy.
I do wonder if this is, at least these days, a bit of an elite obsession, that is, that it's the political class that senses this, has this profound anxiety about our security. I'm not sure the average person is really worried about being invaded.
Well, all the studies show that the ordinary people think there'll be a war with China within 5 years. There's a lot of evidence for that.
Which is not a crazy prediction either.
But it is a crazy prediction if you weren't silly enough to be on the American side of that. I don't want to talk about Taiwan today, and I've been to Taiwan a lot, but, you know, we can love the Taiwanese people, but the idea that Taiwan isn't part of China is just mad. Hmm. And we can't go along with American madness, as we've done for far too long, and we can't go along with British madness. We have to become independent in foreign policy without losing allies.
Yeah.
I mean, you do have to stay with the United States, as we once stood with Britain. We weren't totally wrong about that. Obviously, when you had German New Guinea, it wasn't silly to be a bit worried about South Africa.
Yeah.
It's hard to reconstruct that now, but it does make a sense.
Yeah, yeah. highlight a contradiction, which I am very intrigued by and I think is very well observed, and that is that there is a pervasive concept of egalitarianism. I don't think it's just a concept. I think Australia is a very egalitarian society in one sense, and yet there is a comfort level, an acceptance, you say, of extreme wealth, structural inequality, and political corruption. So what's going on here?
Well, I think the egalitarianism has to be very carefully defined. I don't think it's an egalitarian society, and I don't think it's ever been an egalitarian society. It has, there are contexts in which Australians perform egalitarian ritual. They do this under certain circumstances. I would be unkind and say they don't do it when it matters. I think the whole egalitarian thing is a sort of charade in many ways. I mean, if you say, what is the average Australian trying to do? They're trying to get richer.
Mm.
If you ask how much money they gave to Africa last year, I think you'd find that 90% of Australians didn't give anything to Africa last year. I think the egalitarianism, it partly emerged through the settlement pattern as a kind of, there was a resentment in parts of the country, certainly Sydney and Melbourne, I think, against some aspects of Britishness, the class society thing, and some people who could never succeed in the class society because they were the wrong ethnicity or the wrong religion, and the wrong religion was important, they began to push an egalitarian thing, which really meant we can get up too.
Mm.
It wasn't egalitarianism they were arguing for. It was their right to be part of the ruling class, which meant that the British norm couldn't survive. And so there was an opposition to that side of Britishness. But it's also important to realise there were extremely non-egalitarian sides of Australia. I mean, Melbourne, until very recently, was one of the most snobbish cities in the world. I mean, everywhere in Melbourne, people ask you what school you went to. Girls' schools in Melbourne are still, by international standards, unimaginably snobbish. The University of Melbourne still regards itself as one of the great universities in the world. There's a tendency in Melbourne to think that Melbourne is culturally superior to anywhere in Europe. This is increasingly preposterous. But certainly when I was a child, you went to Melbourne and you met people who regarded Melbourne as a world cultural capital. They absolutely did. So, and Adelaide is left out of a lot of this Australian debate. I mean, Adelaide, of course, didn't have convicts. Adelaide had lots and lots of prosperous free settlers. The idea that these people were egalitarian, Adelaide was never egalitarian. Adelaide was a place where very rich people went to posh Anglican private schools and led the Labour Party. It isn't that they weren't, they were committed, and this inverts our whole discussion, they were committed to a kind of justice. And they were often progressive in their views over a whole range of things. That's quite fair. But they weren't wanting to have the tradespeople in the garden, and they didn't want them to come and spoil the opera.
Yeah.
I mean, Australian music is another brilliant example. We do have a country music scene, and we do have a pop music scene up to a point, but nothing on the scale of Korea. And we do have an opera world. Now, the opera world is about as non-egalitarian as anything could ever be.
Yeah, and obviously the idea that we are an egalitarian society is not going to meet with assent amongst Indigenous people for obvious reasons. But it's interesting that cultures can develop perceptions about themselves that embed in the culture, and it's possible that they're true in one or more senses one particular time.
And in certain
contexts. And then they can argue, you know, perhaps they cease to be true, but the self-perception doesn't adapt to the changing reality. And so I think, would you agree that Australia definitely considers itself egalitarian? That's one of the virtues we think we have.
Australia doesn't mean equal. It means some hostility to social ranking.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Something like that. For example, what is very Australian is that you're not allowed to notice or be distressed by the complete social incompetence of another Australian.
Mm.
So you can go into Australian Parliament and not know a foreign language and no one would laugh at you.
Yeah.
Well, that wouldn't be the case in most of the rest of the world. We can have someone in the government who has a very basic grasp of English and certainly doesn't have complex English words.
Yeah.
You're not allowed to laugh at them. So there is a toleration of people who are socially inept and intellectually bankrupt
Yeah.
And they have to be regarded as normal. That's a very strong Australian norm. But if you take the case of education, you see, we already see that we're pouring government money by the bucketful into private schools who don't need it, underfunding our private school system, our public school system,
yeah.
and then having private schools that in their own way are clearly quite excellent, that have obscene fees, and this is not seen as a problem by the Australian population.
Yeah.
So there are all kinds of cases where the alleged egalitarianism would lead to a social judgment, but it doesn't.
Yeah. I think you can see it in certain cultural manifestations and contrasts. So, you know, it's always struck me as it may seem superficial, but I think this does flesh out the egalitarian point, although it does illustrate the limitations that you've drawn attention to, that, you know, the idea that if you serve as president of the United States, then you are always referred to as president for the rest of your life. And really, it would be considered extremely disrespectful,
yes.
even if you didn't like that person. Like even a Trump opponent in a formal setting is going to say President Trump, whereas in Australia, you know, if you meet a prime minister, they're going to say, hi, I'm John, or hi, I'm Julia, or I'm Tony, or I'm Scott, or I'm Kevin. And we wouldn't hesitate to use their first name once they're out of office. We would use the title in a more formal setting. And it's interesting because I used to think this was just a curious facet of American culture. But as you know, I know I'm very familiar with Greek culture, and I discovered they're identical. So the idea that you would refer to you as yes. anything other than yes. Professor Hudson, even if I was also a professional and maybe 60 years old, like it just wouldn't happen. My father, when he was in America, could not get his students to call him Graham. They just could not bring themselves to call him anything other than Professor Cole. And
yes,
my
yes,
wife and yes. I, when we went to the Greek embassy here in Canberra yes. to yes. were renewing her Greek passport, it was fascinating. The people working in the embassy were referring to each other as Mr. and Mrs. So-and-so by their surname, like a level of formality
yes.
that you wouldn't expect from Greeks necessarily.
I think you've now got it right. You see, it's not about egalitarianism, it's about formality.
Mm.
When you should be formal and when you should not be formal, and what the social meaning of formal is.
Mm.
Because they were in societies where there were representatives of the crown who were enforcing British concepts of formality.
Mm.
And those concepts were really quite dominant in upper circles into the 1960s
mm.
on a scale that no young Australian could even imagine. You know, so it was, the British norms were in force in the upper section of the society.
We had sirs and dames in those days.
Well,
as well.
The example that is very stark, I mean, my father-in-law, who was involved with the Merino sheep, and he would go and work on the land with a diversity of peoples and speak a very broad Australian. And then at night he would have dinner with the family that owned the property in a dinner suit and speak of a more formal Australian. And certainly there'd be no colourful language over dinner. And this was the way the society was. But this eventually did erode through migration.
Mm.
And so the egalitarian thing to some extent meant not using British ranking systems in a country that wasn't British anymore.
Yeah.
You saw it when they gave that award to Prince Philip.
Mm.
There was a national yeah. feeling that this was inept.
Yeah.
And why yeah. was it inept? Well, because that's not our social recognition process.
So perhaps what it is a social egalitarianism.
Yes, it's a social recognition.
Not an economic or...
It's not economic, it's not political. It's a social recognition thing.
Yeah.
And it has changed. I mean, you have to be careful of essentialistic Australianism here because it wasn't the case before 1960.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean,
well, again, this harks back to that earlier point about the slow transition out of the British
yes.
Empire milieu yes. or context, and
it's important to emphasise differences in different parts of Australia. Again, you have to be careful mm. about this idea that they're all the same in Darwin. And I mean, I spent a lot of time, as you know, in Tasmania, and if I got into a taxi in Tasmania, it wouldn't be uncommon for a driver, an older person, to say, good morning, Squire.
Really?
I wouldn't expect to be called Squire in Canberra.
Yeah.
And I certainly wouldn't be called Squire in Darwin.
Mm.
But these cultural norms were slightly different
yeah.
in different parts of Australia.
Yeah.
They were.
Well, this is always the challenge, isn't it? To talk about a nation or a nation state.
Exactly.
Because it evolves over time. And even the conceptuality evolves because, as we know, that term secular means something very different now than it did 100 years ago in Australia, even in legislation where the term secular in the various education acts, you know, it did mean just a non-denominational, non-sectarian Christianity. Just to bring this home, and there is one other thing I just want to touch on briefly before we finish, but this one other point of originality that I find really interesting is you contend that there's a relatively weak sense of political identity at the state level and concept of state rights, and that really resonated with me as true if you know anything about America, for example.
Yes, it's not true for Western Australia.
And oh, of course, yeah.
That's an obvious exception where there is a strong sense of identity. And, of course,
even today.
they tried to leave, as you know, and there's still a certain separatist.
There's definitely, I would say, of all the states, a sense of separateness and distinctness. When I first went to Perth and I flew there from Canberra, and I shared a cab with a young guy from Perth who had been on his first trip to Canberra, and I was doing my first trip to WA, and he was excitedly talking to the cab driver about this foreign country on the East Coast and was talking about Easterners and Canberra like it was this exotic foreign. And I was just, and it kind of, whereas for me, I thought I was just going to another part of Australia. And of course, it was this strange collision of worlds, and I felt like an alien in this cab as these two Western Australians talked about the East Coast.
To emphasize one of the themes of our whole conversation, that it was more so in the past.
Yeah.
When I went to Western Australia for the first time, I would have been about 16, and I had meetings with the Premier and so on and so on, and I had never met people like this. The English was not the English spoken in the Eastern States. They had different pronunciations of even basic words. It was much more stuffy and formal than anything in Sydney. And it had a sort of old world quality, which would have been Singapore before the Japanese arrived. It was, you could say, Singapore 1940. There was a lot of that in Perth in about 1962. Mm. So these states all need to be studied historically. And Queensland is, of course, the extreme case because although Queensland is still seen as a little bit exotic, it was infinitely
exotic. A little bit.
Well, in the past, it was much more. I mean, it had a slave economy.
Yeah.
And when I first went to Brisbane in 1952 as a child, there was no proper transport in the city. Mm. There were no toilets inside the houses. You couldn't imagine what the level of the city was like. And they had no library. They had a university, which was built in Italian fascist architecture. I mean, Queensland was another universe. Mm. And North Queensland was an entirely different universe.
So it's definitely, particularly if we go back historically, there are different patterns of settlement.
Yes.
We can talk about the Germans and the
wealthier
free settlers in
the
South
North,
Australia.
I mean, Henry Reynolds makes the point, and it's absolutely right and still not grasped. Yeah. North Queensland was always Asia Pacific.
Yeah.
The people on the street spoke a variety of Asian languages.
But the larger point that I want to get back to, which is interesting, is that you don't have these strong constituencies arguing for state rights. I know that premiers have a bit of, they fight amongst themselves and with the Fed, with Canberra over GST distribution and things like that, but it hardly excites the average New South Welsh man or woman. Yes, it comes out a bit in sport, but that's probably attenuated by the fact that different states play different sports, for example. So, in AFL, the rivalry, which has kind of died, was South Australia and Victoria for a long time, whereas in rugby league, it's Queensland and New South Wales. And so depending where you live, there aren't these. But anyway, there is a bit of the state identity comes out a little bit in sport. But most listeners will be familiar that in the US, there are these really strong state identities and the states have colourful histories and they have much more different laws, it seems, and really different characters and fierce kind of local loyalties in a way that is kind of rare. I know there was the old Sydney-Melbourne rivalry, which is so lukewarm these days as to be a bit pathetic, I think. But again, nothing that's really emerged, notwithstanding the WWA example, yes, where they did try to leave the Federation and weren't able to.
I think you could argue that the real identity of most Australians is an English-speaking media identity.
Mm, interesting.
And you'd notice that if you looked at the television they actually watch.
A kind of ABC identity.
An awful lot of it is American TV.
Oh, that's true, yeah.
And almost all of it is in English.
Well, these days it's not really TV. It's YouTube and
also the
podcasting
same. And more and of the same.
Social
and
media.
But this is identity, isn't it? You see, I mean, it's not like it was in 1900 or in 1940. You know, if you'd have... Maybe Uluru is a good example of this, because Uluru is a national icon. It's enormously important. It's sacralized. Almost all Australians you know would recognize it as significant in a certain way.
Mm.
And if you said to them, before you die, you should go to Uluru and not go to London,
yeah,
they'd laugh at you.
I think
they'd
that's
true. They'd
prefer
to go to London than Uluru. Now, some would go to Uluru, obviously, but it illustrates there's a kind of Anglo-Saxon world thing in this story, I think. And migration paradoxically adds to it, because you'd imagine all these people coming in would turn into Aussies.
Mm.
But it's the other way around. Aussie expands to include them.
Yeah.
So you can be a Malaysian Muslim woman and be Australian.
Yeah.
So the attempt, which was very strong when I was a child. I mean, you can't believe it now, but when I was a child, you couldn't speak a foreign language on an Australian train. And if somebody started to speak Italian to another person on an Australian train, they came out to them and said, don't speak foreign.
Really?
There was absolute intolerance of anything except English on the street. No one was allowed to speak Chinese either much or anything else. Now, through migration, Aussies expanded to include a vast number of languages, a vast number of places of origin, and the common culture becomes civic exchange, if you like. You're supposed to be a civic exchange, civil person, and almost everyone is. One of our great successes. Everybody in Australia is very sensitive to the other person. If you go to the shopping mall, there are no people laughing at Muslims for wearing a veil.
Mm.
It's not the French story. Every Australian moves over for the culture of the person next to them. If they're heavy beer drinkers, they wouldn't push alcohol on people who were from a country that didn't have alcohol and so on and so on. But the old attempt to have a nation formation was linked to a kind of shared identity.
Mm.
And it excluded foreign languages and it excluded people of colour.
Mm.
And Aboriginals were part of the exclusion. But it wasn't just Aboriginals.
Yeah, yeah.
You couldn't be Chinese or anything else either. And so now we're in a totally different moment of nation formation.
Yeah, I think that's why the story is shifting on the Indigenous question.
Yes.
Like it may actually be that the policy and experience of multiculturalism,
it may be the last thing Australians can claim,
made Australia, white Australia, re-examine,
and it may be the only thing they can claim they have in common.
Yeah,
you see, because again, if you go back to when I first went to Perth or I first went to Victoria, these were very, very rigid identitarian societies, and the women in particular were imitations of London upper class. They dressed in what they thought would be worn in London.
Mm.
It was worn in London 20 years earlier, but they didn't know that. The men had an Australian jocular side, but they had a formal side. It was very striking if you went to a church service, a Protestant church service, because the men would read the Bible in standard English while talking a more Australian in ordinary life. And so there was an identity that was from another world.
Well, so it was the era where the ABC had this weird faux posh accent that was Australian in one sense. But
well, the extreme case
aping
was,
British.
Was the cricket. The cricket commentator was a man called Michael Charlton, and he had 150,000% British accent. And not only did they love him, but they thought he was quintessentially Australian.
Mm.
If you heard him now, you'd faint.
Yeah.
I mean, it wasn't just an English accent. It was 150% an English accent. And he did the Australian nationalist bit on the cricket.
Yeah.
So that, and Menzies was like that. See, again, young Australians can't quite grasp that when Menzies said he was British to his bootstraps and raved about the Queen, he had overwhelming support.
Well, I mean, that visit by a young Queen Elizabeth in the 50s, she was like a sensation, right? She was like the greatest celebrity ever.
I went to see her 8 times.
8 times? Wow. Truth comes out. I saw her no times.
There was no sense that she was the Queen of England.
Yeah, yeah.
There was no sense at all that she was the Queen of England.
Yeah.
Yeah. She was the Queen.
Yeah, yeah. No,
and,
I get it.
And my wife had to go in boiling heat in the centre of Australia to see her. And so did every other child. It was primary identity.
Well, it goes to this point that even in one or two generations, things can be really different. Because for me, she's always felt like a foreign queen. But that
Charlie feels totally foreign now. You see, Charlie doesn't strike any Australian as being, you know, part of Australia.
Well, I find as an Australian, you have to consciously remind yourself that we're a constitutional monarchy and that this is monarch, because the monarch is so remote and plays no role politically. And so unless you really want to follow them in a magazine where they're treated like a celebrity,
but
you have to go looking for news about them.
That was not true.
No, I know.
In a way you can't imagine.
Yeah, no.
I mean, they didn't see them as foreign.
Yeah.
They listened to the King's speech every year.
Yeah.
And it wasn't the King of England they were listening to.
Well, I even remember...
It was the King.
I remember in the 80s, my entire family watching the marriage of Diana.
Yes.
And even then, this was like a massive... Yeah. It wasn't purely celebrity then, because Australia wasn't really plugged into a celebrity culture. Well, it was, I think it was the last moment in a way of that era.
Yes.
And I was just a young kid. And then as I became an adult, like I say, out of sight, out of mind. But we can't bring this home without saying something about liberalism. And it's interesting that the term liberalism hasn't even come up in the conversation yet. And
I think
many historians and scholars would name liberalism as one of the major ingredients in the pot of what Australia is, and maybe even in what makes it unique. And I would be interested in just a comment from you on that, because I know you have interesting views.
I think what you might say is that you might say that liberalism is the only political tradition in Australia, and that communists and anarchists and all kinds of people who are anti-liberal are in the end in one of the heretical parts of the liberal tradition rather than anything else. And you could test that empirically by what they think when a foreign government seizes an Australian journalist.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a pretty common feeling in Australia that should not be happening. I think that's across almost any possible political allegiance. But the liberalisms that came here were money, and the historiography is no good because the people who write it have a Unitarian conception of liberalism. And so they assume that all liberals were sort of the same. Now, of course, they noticed that Deaconite social liberals were different to free trade liberals and so on and so on. But they don't grasp the European heritage, because there are liberals, of course, in most European countries. But in Australia, British liberals are important in Australia, certainly. They have a reception. But Russian liberalism has no significant impact here. It would have some impact in Brisbane in the Russian press, but essentially Australians now couldn't answer simple questions about Russian liberalism. They've never even heard of the main names. So lots of international liberalism doesn't come here. And so the discussion of liberalism in Australia is always rather pathological, in that they've heard of American stuff, which they call liberal, although a lot of it is not liberal in any way, but American republicanism.
Mm.
And you could say anti-liberal in some ways. As you see with Trump, the last thing you'd say about Trump is that he's a liberal. There's no liberalism in Trump at all. So the Australians muddle their American thing with the liberalism thing. Then they don't really grasp the Scottish dimension. So they talk about liberalism as a sort of eternal essence. But there were lots of different liberalisms here. There were social liberalisms, idealist liberalisms, different liberalisms, and different in different parts of the country. And in a way, the point about liberalism here is that it isn't a European liberalism, and it's certainly not American. And it does have some Australian characters. And one of the interesting questions is, what are they and where they came from? Now, I'm the wrong person to ask about that, because I know a bit about it, but not enough. Ian Tregenza is the person who is doing wonderful work on that. And when it comes out, it will change our thinking, because liberalism has changed at different times. Ian thinks that an original liberalism emerged in Australia, and we've forgotten. I think that's right.
Okay, sounds like I'll have to get Ian back on the podcast. But Wayne, thanks again for a very stimulating conversation. Always an absolute blast to talk to you. And folks, if you enjoyed the show, give it a 5-star rating on Apple and or Spotify. Subscribe if you haven't already. And as always, thanks for listening.